Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody. Happy New Year. This is our first podcast of 2021, actually. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Tim Brennan, the CEO, and Mr. Bernhard Brock, the CISO of SysArk. They're leading a cybersecurity and MSP firm based out of Rockville, Maryland. Bernhard and Tim, thanks for your time. Let's go ahead and get started, please.
Pleasure to meeting you.
Yeah, thank you for your time. Now, Bernhard and Tim, we looked up both your bios. We kind of did some background snooping on you on LinkedIn and on Google to kind of see what your backgrounds were like. Can you kind of both elaborate on your backgrounds and how you got started in cybersecurity? Whoever would like to go first, that'd be great.
Go ahead, Bernhard.
Actually, when I came over in the States in 2006, I joined an MSP then that was mostly working for credit unions and other security-oriented clients. And my boss had a CSSP, and it was something that really piqued my interest. I wanted to get into it, and daily life just made it happen. And so I got my CSSP, I got my certifications for more security orientations, and it was daily life. It was daily life to run intrusion detection systems, and it was daily life to run what back then was like precursors of SIEM tools today. We were just collecting data for the firewalls, but that was already pretty well. So that's how it got started, and then when I moved from Hawaii to D.C., it was I joined SysArk, and I brought my enthusiasm and my feeling for security and the need that security needs to be the foundation of everything in IT with me, and that from there it went.
Excellent. Tim?
Yeah, so I'm a native Washingtonian, and I've been in the IT business since the early 80s. So I've been around a lot. I've worked for several government contractors like Booz Allen and CACI. In my career, I was a technical person early on for the first 10 years, and then I started my own firm back in the 90s or late 80s, and that was a software development company. And so I ran that for 5 years and then sold it and then started working for some startups in the D.C. area during the dot-com boom and did very well there until it all went bust. And then I started SysArk in 2004, and we were mostly started as a managed services provider helping local D.C.-based companies do IT support and, you know, basically outsource their network support for them. And about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, we added a cybersecurity practice to that firm. So, and there we are today.
Well, that was kind of congratulations on that. That was going to lead me to my next question. What motivated you to start SysArk? Was it just an entrepreneurial itch or just a void you felt that needed to be filled in the security realm?
Yeah, so you know, I'd started a firm in my mid 20s, late 20s, and ran that. And then I had a couple kids in that time frame, and so I got out of having my own company and really just worked for somebody else so I could, because I was working, you know, how entrepreneurs are, they work 15-hour days. So I spent the next 15 years working for other startups in different kinds of sales and marketing management roles. And then when my kids got, you know, to high school or above, I always had that itch to start another firm. So you know, I picked managed services. It was kind of odd, but I was doing a lot of work with Microsoft, and they were, I was doing some projects with them. And then when we'd finish, there was nobody there to support those projects. So there was a need for, you know, helping companies, especially small, you know, businesses who didn't have, you know, an IT team to you know, have a solution for them. But, you know, the thing that got us into cybersecurity, sorry if I'm going on too long here, but what got us into cybersecurity About 6 years ago, some of our customers were government contractors. One of them in particular had a lot of work with the FBI, and Bernard had just joined our firm, and really the only guy who had any cyber expertise in his background. But so this, you know, in that time frame, that the anonymous hacking group was getting into a lot of the FBI contractors' systems, right? And so our customer was very concerned there, and so we just jumped right in and did whatever we could, mostly using Bernard's expertise, to really make sure that our customer was protected. And fortunately, our customer was not one of those companies that got hacked. So that got us really motivated and interested in building, that expertise across all of our customers.
Okay, excellent. Now, how did you get the name Sysark? It's a very unique name.
Yeah, I'm not that creative. It started out as System Architects, and I just, I looked for, it was back in 2004, what URL was available, a short URL. And so anyway, I came up with that, and it gets mispronounced, and people go, what the heck is that? But that's really the genesis of it.
Yeah, excellent. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well? Are you just locally based in Washington, or what's your reach like?
So we started out as a local Washington, D.C. metro area company, but once we got into cyber, 4 or 5 years ago, our reach has expanded across the U.S., and actually we have a couple international customers, but we don't have physical, small physical presence on the West Coast, but in general, all of our people work out of, the D.C. area. But our customers now are across the U.S. And the nice thing about the cyber, right, is what we're doing is we don't have to be on site. With the network support, you have to be on site a little bit to do, hand-holding and set up computers and physically do some things. But with cyber, you really don't have to do much of that. So our reach has expanded dramatically in that capability.
Excellent. Now, who is your typical customer base like? Is it the Fortune 500 or the mom-and-pop stores or the SMBs or really anybody who could use an MSP? Like, it could be a combination of all three, maybe?
Yeah, so we, we're SMB mostly, right? But we usually can help people who have 25 employees up to 500 is kind of, it's sort of a wide range, but so we don't help the mom and pops that much, but with cyber, we're getting into the larger opportunities and larger companies. We've worked with some multinational companies on some of these, CMMC projects, and then expanded our footprint in those organizations once they see what we can do for them. So it's primarily SMB, and we're really focused these days on the aerospace and defense industry, primarily because we're really going after that CMMC, defense industrial base supply chain market.
Okay. Well, we're going to be doing a big, big, huge deep dive in CMMC here in just a couple of minutes. But before we do that, let's just talk a little bit more about your other services, the risk and management components and the managed cybersecurity managed services. Can you kind of explain a little bit more to our audience the differences between the two and what you offer?
Sure. we're considered an MSP, which is a managed service provider. That's where we got our start. That was our core offering. And that's network support, which includes like things like 24/7 monitoring and alerting, help desk, NOC services, IT management. And we also have a design sort of build professional services team that helps our managed services customers implement new technology. And so that's been our core sort of set of services. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, we added what I call MSSP, you know, managed security services, provider services. And it's similar, right? So it's managed security on an outsourced model. It's, you know, security monitoring, you know, incident response, SOC services, you know, compliance program oversight and management, you know, and consulting services. So we offer like a full managed service offering or partial. You know, some companies, especially when they're larger, they have IT teams that can do some of this stuff. And so we can augment their teams, you know, by providing an outsourced SOC or for providing a, you know, a fractional CISO service to manage their, you know, their cyber program or so. So it's, you know, it's mostly managed services, and on the front end of those services, we usually offer, you know, a cybersecurity assessment either for compliance reasons or for just general how do we get, you know, our cybersecurity program started and provide us a roadmap. So that's the general gist of what we do.
Okay, excellent. Now let's go into one of the biggest buzzwords this year so far has been cybersecurity, and that is the CMMC. Now, for a lot of people who may not be in that so-called defense industrial base, can you explain to them what is the CMMC and what it stands for, and can you provide a high-level overview of what it's really all about and what its main purpose or objective is?
Sure. Bernard, I'll give a quick overview, and you can jump in and add to it if you'd like. Apologize for dominating this piece, but Bernard's the technical wizard and subject matter expert around CMMC, and I'm just the sort of the high level guy. But in general, CMMC is Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification. That's what it stands for, and I call it DFARS 2.0. So before CMMC came out in 2017 or before, there was something, you know, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, so it's the DoD Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement, I think it's the DFARS. That came out in 2015, and it was due at the end of 2017 around implementing, and it was called DFARS 252.204, you know, dash 7012 or so. Anyway, it was around implementing the NIST 800-171 cybersecurity requirements, basically, in order to help the DoD, you know, reduce the amount of theft going on within their supply chain by adversaries who were looking to take our intellectual property, you know, national security intellectual property by nation states, you know, stealing our plans for, you know, the next generation, you know, fighter planes or submarines or what have you, right? And so that came out and lasted, you know, a couple years, and it was mostly a self sort of, you know, honor system to get your company, if you're a supplier, you know, in a better place around cybersecurity so that, you know, you'd be harder to break into and the supply chain would be stronger. And they didn't get a lot of cooperation from industry on that. You know, the large primes certainly jumped on board and, you know, had already been doing that because, you know, they had a lot to lose. But the supply chain that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, some say 300,000 companies in the supply chain. Some of them are very small, and they, you know, were either not, you know, interested in making that investment or just didn't know what they needed to do and if it even applied to them, right? So along comes CMMC last year, well, 2019, because DFARS 7012 wasn't really being enforced and wasn't really working. So so that's why I call it DFARS 2.0. Two major changes came, you know, with CMMC in my view. There's an enforcement mechanism. That's the audit and getting certified through an audit process to, you know, enforce the requirements on the companies. And if they're not certified, they don't get additional business. And then they also added multiple levels of security requirements based on the type of data that an organization might handle. So there's levels 1 through 5, level 1 being a contractor that really doesn't handle any sensitive data. They might be a landscaper on a DOD contract somewhere, you know, don't have really any what, and Bernard can talk about CUI and the kinds of data that they're trying to protect. But that's really the high level of what CMMC is and why they're doing it. Bernard, did you have anything to add?
Yeah. Additionally, it's the first attempt when NIST 171 came in, it was purely based on confidentiality in the triad of IT security between confidentiality, integrity, and availability. The whole emphasis was on confidentiality. We have encryption and so on, and access control. The CMMC has realized that there was a couple of things missing versus DFAS 1.0. NIST 171 was pure in this direction, and then they went added on more risk management, more pure backups and pure simple things that goes more also into integrity and into availability, better email spoofing protection, for instance. So, and then they added something very important to it. They added the maturity element to it. The maturity makes the difference. It makes a difference from, oh yeah, I'm doing it, to I'm doing it consistently, I'm doing it well, I'm managing it, I'm checking up on it, I know what I'm doing, it becomes a habit. From just doing it to a habit, that's really the difference between 171 and the first DFAS rules over to CMMC, making security a habit. The other buzzword there was making it the foundation. But what really is, it's maturity and habit is that what really goes together in this and needs to be really emphasized, because it means don't just do it, but do it consistently. And you have to prove it that you have done it consistently. So still
okay,
high level, hopefully.
Okay. Maybe this is too early to ask this question, I'm not sure, but when I've done my writings on the CMMC, the two biggest things are the data sets, the FCI and the CUI.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a breakdown between the two and what are the differences between the two?
Yeah. So they both start with the same same elements. It is everything you get from the government, everything you do for the government, and everything you give back to the government. And which is not publicly available and what's not supposed to be published. So that's the basic. That's FCI. CUI is FCI plus. So there are 20 categories that have been defined, and the definitions are all available at the National Archives, was responsible for the CUI program, that goes deeper in there. Those are legally, again, defined as data that need extra protection and that the government is allowed to have because they have extra protection, that is data that might be holden or created for the government with extra protection and that needs to be reviewed. So CUI is, while FCI can be everything that is partly of the billing that can be internal, how you do certain things, the CUI part is in some ways relatable to what people realize that are the protections for PII, for personal information. So it goes further. PII is that relates to those contracts is actually CUI as well. Controlled technical information, layouts, diagrams, all the technical information that comes on top of it, unclassified nuclear information. So let's take a step back. All of those informations, FCI and CUI, is unclassified. We are not talking about secret. We are not talking about top secret. It is still all unclassified, but it is still data that needs protection. Some of those protections are obvious. Again, PII, health information. We want to have a privacy. All those elements that are out there with GDPR and the Californian Privacy Act, That all goes into the same direction, but it goes further on. There are certain elements that are very much unclassified information that needs extra protection, and that's the one that goes. In very short, as a very shorthand, it is also the IP, the intellectual property, that makes the difference between a simple element that is out there that you can buy and something that really gives more value and that makes the U.S. government, the U.S. military stronger and gives it the edge. That's
so, Bernard, one of the things I'd add to that is, you know, it's been confusing to a lot of the customers that we talk to, especially the small supply chain folks. They don't really understand what CUI is all the time because the government was supposed to be marking CUI, and they hadn't really been doing a good job of that, and they admit that. And so one of the things with CMMC that they're trying to do internally is make sure that they've trained all of their contracting officers and all the other folks that are responsible within the DoD to mark, you know, the CUI as CUI so that companies understand, you know, exactly what CUI they have and what to do with it and where to put it. And if they have a problem or a breach or something, where to go find it and make sure it's been, you know, protected and safe, et cetera. So you know, I think that's an important point.
Yeah, the marking is a sore point for everybody. The government, there has been a DoD instruction in March, May this year, 2020, that really enforced marking to outside DoD sources better, but people are still in training. On the other hand, in the end, if you know what makes your product and what makes your project different, that's what you need to protect. And yes, it is a challenge, but I think people need to understand the adversaries are out there and they want to get it. Protect your data as if it was CUI anyway.
Yeah. Excellent. Now, how did this start get started into the CMMC compliance realm?
So, 5 or so years ago, 2017, we just had some customers in the DoD space, right, who were DoD contractors, and they came to us. Again, the first customer before that came, you know, was FBI-related. They didn't have this same issue, but they had another issue. And so we became aware that we needed to start getting some expertise. And then shortly thereafter, in early 2017, we had a couple customers ask us to help us with DFAR 7012. And then, you know, once we helped a couple of these customers, you know, I really saw this as a big need and a big opportunity for us. So we started back in 2017 and really focusing on that. And Bernard and I, you know, really kind of came up with our program and started building out our, you know, competency around this. And we really have laser focused on this problem for the last 4 years. And what I'd say in that time was that we'd go to these customers and they were like, oh my God, we can't spend all this money on this issue. They're telling us we got to spend all this money. So we quickly figured out, especially as an MSP, because that's what we do anyway, how to do this really efficiently, as low cost as we can, to help these people get what they need to get. And so I think when we started, we've reduced the cost of this to our customers from when we started 4 years ago to now probably by 50%, just by being more efficient, using better tools, and just understanding the process and how it works.
Also, time-wise, one of the big ones, an assessment in 2017 took weeks and weeks and weeks. You had to talk. It was still very much on the basis of a traditional audit without focusing really what are the gaps, what are the fixes that you needed to put in place to, A, create better security, and, B, become compliant, two things that are not necessarily always the same. So, but finding a good mix there, and that has we have done this down now to a science to really talk to people to find the right language to have a discussion with them, because one of the things that we also learned about the whole CMMC is that we can't build new networks for most of the times. We have to deal with what is already in place. So whoever thinks there is a silver bullet is wrong because there are way too many targets. And that's why we learned a lot to really identify, speak the language, understand the concerns, and finding cost-efficient solutions for security and compliance there.
Okay, excellent. Now, Tim or Bernard, where does CISARC fit into this role in the CMMC? Can you walk us through the entire process, like a high-level overview, when you first talk to a customer to when you end your engagement with the customer when it comes to CMMC? What's the whole process like? What's the overview?
Yeah, so when we talk to almost all customers, they are starting on their journey, right? Some of them have gone down this path on their own a little bit and get frustrated and or make some progress. But in general, most of them are starting their journey. So we always start with an assessment. You know, we call it a readiness assessment. Some people call it a gap analysis. But basically, for CMMC, we just use the, you know, CMMC requirements. I think, Bernard, how many? It's NIST 800-171 plus 20 or 30, depending on what level.
20 controls, yes, for level 3.
Yeah. Yeah, so out of that, right, we give them an SSP and a POEM, system security plan and a plan of action and milestones, and a set of recommendations for what they need to do get through this journey from, you know, starting all the way to compliance. And so we have the capabilities to help them all the way through that process and actually do it all in an outsource model, or we have the capability to help them in certain areas, right? You know, early on, nobody wanted to write any of the 20 or so policy documents that have to be written for all the different control families. So we do a lot of that work. It's funny, we're finding larger companies come to us and asking us to do evidence collecting, you know, project in advance of getting audited. But we also help with what a lot of people refer to as the remediation process, which is taking the gaps and closing those gaps through some kind of remediation effort. Sometimes that's just us implementing our managed service that has a set of tools and processes and resources, you know, like a SIM tool and a SOC, et cetera, multi-factor authentication, et cetera. Or we just do a project for them. We ran across a large multinational company that had been breached, had several business units, and they wanted us to rebuild 100 servers, you know, like and harden them, you know, pretty large project, as well as implement some tools. But they had a lot of the other services. So it's, you know, it's always a customized solution for what the company's needs and requirements are based on, you know, what resources and tools they already have in place. You know, but most of the small guys don't have anything in place, and so we can do from A to Z and get them ready for an audit, and then we'll sit with them during the audit whenever that audit happens.
Okay, excellent. Now, one question I was going to ask you is, Tim, there's a lot of stuff out there, like all these acronyms, buzzwords, like assessor, compliance checker, certifier. Can you actually certify businesses to prove that they are CMMC compliant, or can you just do the assess? I mean, you talk about assessment, so, now, do you actually actual thing, or do you just tell people, here's what you need to do, or are you?
Yeah, so
go ahead.
Yeah, so we're part of the ecosystem and have been. You know, right now we're a registered provider organization, a CMMC registered provider, and that's really a consultant, right, company. We signed up to be a 3CPAO as well. And those are the companies that will do the audits, right? They're just similar to the FedRAMP, you know, 3PAOs. But all those folks are in pilot mode right now, right? So they, you know, I think there's a couple of companies or a few that have actually been granted their C-3PAO badges, as you will. You know, that, and we may go down that route, right, just to have that expertise and that training. But we're probably not going to be doing too many of those audits, right? We consider an assessment, a readiness assessment, is really the precursor to helping somebody understand where they are versus an audit. And they're calling the people who do audits assessors. So it's I'm not sure exactly why they do that, but they're really auditors, right? That are able to certify. So we are not one of those firms. We're helping people along the way, and we'll sit with them when they have an audit because we've helped them do all this work, and we have most of the answers. And then Bernhard, we have Bernhard and a few others on our staff that are, what are you, registered professionals?
We're still registered professionals because the certification is still out by end of Q2, beginning Q3.
Yeah.
So at the moment, they are only really provisional auditors and everything else there. I'm a registered RP, registered practitioner at the moment.
So that brings up another question I had, Bernhard. I was talking to one of my clients who I'm right now writing a white paper for on the CMMC, mm-hmm. and she was saying that nobody can really get certified right now. So I'm assuming that won't happen until
technically.
The end of Q3?
Technically, yes.
Am I correct?
Technically, the way it's complicated because simply we have to acknowledge this is still being built. And they're building the ship while it's already afloat. Technically, we have at the moment provisional assessors, and provisional assessors will give provisional certifications. Those provisional certifications will need to be amended once there are final rules and final regulations out there. So then they will have to go through a delta. But we are at the moment in the Pathfinder space of the CMMC. So there are certain companies need to be going through this so we learn how this whole thing works. It's really learning by doing.
So basically, you know, they're in pilot mode this year, and they got bumped by a year partially because of COVID, but partially because it's just taking so long to move this, turn this ship around, right? So in September, what they realized this past September or so, that they were only going to, they were supposed to do the pilot program for 1,500 companies and certify 1,500 companies or so last year, and they didn't get to it, and they're just getting to it now. So in September of 2020, they created this interim rule. It's a DFARS 7012 interim rule, and then it had, you know, what they did there was they said, look, DFARS 7012 is still a requirement around, you know, NIST 800-171, and they're going to enforce a little bit of this because what they said was anyone who gets an award after November 30th, 2020, and there's CUI in your, you know, in this agreement, and they put the DFARS 7012 in your agreement, you have to have an assessment and a score on that assessment and a poem. So that started getting people really ramped up and building their programs out who otherwise might wait for 2 years for CMMC to actually get around to getting to them, right? And so we saw literally, we talked to hundreds of companies between November and the end of December, you know, 2020, trying to get their assessments done and their scores, you know, put into this database that was called the SPRS database that got everybody sort of, you know, jump started who wasn't already down the path. And so, you know, we're still probably not going to see any more than those pilot programs, you know, contractors get audited this year by the provisional assessors. But what this jumpstart thing did was give everybody the, okay, well, next year in 2022, you're going to get audited most likely, and you need to have 6 months to a year of maturity under your belt if you want to pass a, you know, a CMMC audit. So we're seeing a lot more people jump in here because of that interim rule.
Okay. Now, one thing that I've been getting kind of asked a little bit here and there, like with the CCPA and the GDPR, there are clear-cut financial penalties and so forth. Like with the GDPR, if you're not compliant or if you don't have the right controls in place, it's up, what, 4% of gross revenue, I think. Are there any, like, penalties associated with the CMMC at this point? Because when I was doing my research, I didn't really see anything.
Yeah, there's the biggest one of them all. You don't get the contract. So
okay.
There's no price. You don't get penalized with money in the way that you need to pay a fine. You don't get the contract if you don't have it at time of award, and that's kind of like 100% penalty.
Okay. I got you on that one. Okay. Now, Tim, like the CMMC, okay, it's this big thing out there, this big nebulous cloud out there. What are some of the latest news items that listeners should be aware of? Can you kind of crystallize all this techno jargons, all these acronyms, and kind of tell listeners what they really need to do at this point stage in the game if they're a defense contractor, not even a defense contractor, but are still interested in CMMC?
Yeah, I mean, from our perspective, right, that interim rule really sort of jump-started everybody into at least getting a NIST 800-171 assessment done. And again, if you get that done and that out of that comes a system security plan and a POAM and you have a score, then you've started this process, right? That's everyone needs to have that done, especially if, you know, they have any kind of, you know, DFAR 7012 clause in any agreements that they currently have or that they're going to be bidding on. And so the DoD has definitely been putting that kind of language in all of their new, you know, RFPs. So that's step one. That gets people to at least understand where they are and what they have to do and give them a roadmap and a cost breakdown of how much it's going to cost them and how long it's going to take them to get there. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. So they may not get audited around CMMC for a couple years, but they may fall under this requirement to have their score and this with an assessment. And if their score is low and they're on a program that somebody, you know, thinks is pretty, you know, valuable, they will get audited by DCMA potentially, right? So defense contractor management or something like that agency, they'll be doing random audits throughout the next, you know, 4 years until CMMC is fully rolled out. So you know, those are just everyone needs to have that done. You know, our perspective is really, though, from a cybersecurity company standpoint, we're hoping that companies understand not just their compliance requirements, but how the risk on their business if they're not implementing the latest tools and processes around, you know, advanced cybersecurity. Because ransomware is really a big problem, as you know and everyone knows, but a lot of these business owners don't know about it until they get hit with it. But, you know, we're trying to, you know, get people to you know, protect their entire network, not just because of compliance, but because it's the right business thing to do, because they could go out of business. These ransomware guys are putting a lot of people out of business.
Okay, now, as Bernhard alluded to before, apart from winning the contract, what are some other benefits of getting the CMMC certification eventually at some point in time? What are some other tangible or intangible benefits that a supplier can witness from it?
I think one of the biggest ones is it gives them a competitive advantage over others. You know, say you're a subcontractor and you work with primes. Those primes are looking at their supply chain now and looking at people or companies who've invested in this and who, you know, are, you know, have a good cybersecurity program in place, because this whole program flows down from the primes down to their, all the way through their supply chain. So competitive advantage both from, you know, subcontractor to prime, and if you're a small prime contractor or sole source, you know, you're more competitive advantage, you know, to your customer. So you're a better supplier to your customer. So that's really one big intangible is that. And again, it's reducing your risk around getting breached and having a ransomware attack. Those are the two primary ones we think about. Bernard, anything else?
I think that really hits it. That really hits it, especially if you can prove that you are ready, then from the first moment that you have that you are certified, the certification is good for 3 years. That you can become a sub immediately to someone, and that's a big problem right now for the primes to make sure that all their subs are compliant. At the moment, it's a manual process. Once that is there's certifications out there, the primes will make their life easy and just choose whoever is already compliant. So that will be a big advantage there to get new contracts or become a subcontractor for others.
I got a few more questions about the CMMC, actually.
Sure.
Now, Tim, I read about that. Yeah, it's just not the contractors, not the, like the Lockheed Martins or anything like that, but even the subcontractor who would even write the recipe for the menus of these contractors you're eating your lunch, they had to be CMMC certified. Now, does it really go that deep in the subcontractor level that they had to be certified also? I mean, where does the threshold stop that you don't have to be CMMC certified as a subcontractor?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's every contractor is going to have some level of CMMC certification, you know, at the end of the next 5 years. So you can't qualify to get any DoD contract award, either from your prime or from the government itself. But level one, CMMC level one, is so basic. It's almost like if you have an IT department or any kind of network, and you're not already at level one, then you're just in the dark ages, right? I mean, it's simple things like password change. I mean, it's just so easy to be a level one. So the challenge for a lot of companies is trying to get to level three, and again, that's NIST 800-171 plus of, you know, 20 or so controls. So most people, as far as the DoD is concerned, who fall under DFAR 7012 should already be almost at level three. And so they're wondering why everybody is complaining, because it's not that big of a leap to get to, you know, the extra 20 controls. And they're suggesting that only 30 or 40% of all contractors need to get to level three. But from what we can see, I think most contractors that we talk to want to be at level three, and so, you know, that they need to work towards that. But in general, and here's the other thing. So I think this is going to spread throughout the federal government. They're already talking about this at GSA, and it's actually already coming out in some non-DoD RFPs, asking if they're CMMC level three, or if they've if they've assessed themselves and their DFAR is compliant. So that language is showing up in non-DoD RFPs. So this is going to spread across every federal contractor in the next several years.
Okay. Now there's 5 maturity levels, right? Now, at what point in time will all defense contractors have to achieve level 3, and at what point in time will they have to achieve level 5?
Can I take this?
Yeah.
So, no, not all will have to do with level 3. Everybody will have level 1. That's the most important part. Level 1 will be everybody. Level 3 is only if you have CUI in your network and you manage it. Level 5 will be a very small subgroup of all of it. So according to the interim rule, we are talking about hundreds of companies, not thousands, who will be in level 5. I don't think that anybody was doing daily work and has current contracts with the government, with the DoD, that asking for the DFARS 7012 rule has to worry about level 5. This is really very, very small group, but everybody will have to have level 1, which is just an auditor confirming that they have, that they are compliant with something that they already self-assessed at the moment. That's the FAR 52 rule, that they have basic cybersecurity. That's level 1. So that's where the bandwidth will be. We don't know exactly how many will be level 3, but level 3 will be the most versatile solution. That's why a lot of companies will go for level 3. But level 1 is the one that everybody will have to have.
Okay. Now, Bernhard, here's another question for you. Okay, suppose company XYZ has their headquarters in California and their defense contractor for the DoD. Now, suppose they have a subcontractor that have their that has their physical office presence in, like, India, and they maybe develop the breathing fluid for this new fighter jet coming out. Will this Indian company based out of India, will they have to be CMMC certified as well? Or is a CMMC just based locally for those companies in the U.S., or does it have an international reach also?
That's a very good question. And in general, there has been a lot more emphasis on having companies being U.S.-based. How it essentially will work out if companies outside will become there, it's a very good question. Technically, at the moment, you need, for instance, to submit your score, the SBRS score, the supply performance risk score, to the DoD, you need to have a CAGE code. So if you already went through those process, yes, those companies will get certain certifications. On the other hand, a lot of those contracts will also be CUI and ITAR combined, so there will be a different different requirements there for US being US-based and all together. We will see. We will have to wait out for this a little bit. And we are not lawyers.
Yeah,
that's
a legal question. That's a legal question that Bernard just gave his personal opinion on. So that is being worked out. That they are trying to the guys at the top of the CMMC and the defense industrial base like Lockheed and those guys, they're trying to work that out, right? Because you're going to have three C3PAOs. That are based in India and everywhere else doing those physical audits and assessments. So that is an area that they are challenged with currently, but they're going to work through that over time. But in general, every contractor who's on a contract has to flow down from the top all the way through their supply chain as it's currently written. So they would have to figure out how to deal with that.
Now, Bernhard, I got one more question. Sorry about this. What is a CAGE code? I've seen it written down before, but what is a CAGE code?
It's your identifier for the government. It essentially identifies your company as in billing purposes, and it's your identifier.
Okay. So it's kind of like the Social Security number, right? And put another way.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Well, Tim, I kind of
it's called the commercial and government entity.
Okay. So I kind of want to get back to that topic again of international impacts of it. I mean, in my humble opinion, now, I'm by no means a CMMC specialist or anything like that. I mean, I just touched probably on just maybe the first 0.5% of it with the work I've done with other clients. But I think, in my humble opinion, I think I'm going to throw my 2 cents in there, too. I think that these international companies, they should be impacted, too. Because, I mean, haven't we been hearing stories of, like, China putting in, like, chips into like servers are used by Apple and Google for spying purposes. I mean, I would think this would be a sense of urgency, wouldn't there?
Yes, there is a sense of urgency. I mean, mostly they're trying to protect against those kinds of, you know, nation states
okay.
that are stealing their stuff, right? But you know, the suppliers, you know, from say NATO countries that we're friendly with, that you know build certain components of our, you know, technology, whether it be a plane or a ship or what have you, you know, they're in that supply chain. They need to figure this out, you know. But that is still something they're working on, you know, with the DoD and CMMC folks of how to roll this out to those international companies. And I know they're trying to do that as fast and as quickly as possible, but standing up the U.S. piece of this and getting that started, you know, has been, you know, their primary mission, and I know it's on their minds to deal with the, you know, suppliers of you know, friendly foreign nations.
Now, I've got one more question. Either one of you could answer this. Maybe Bernhard might be able to answer this. Controls.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of controls are you looking at for the CMMC? I mean, what are the groupings? You don't have to do a deep dive into each and every one of them, but like what are some of the categories of controls that a defense contractor would have to implement after they've been audited in order to get that CMMC certification?
There are 130 controls. They go into 17 domains. Those 17 domains start, they're nicely alphabetically ordered, start with access controls and go to system integrity. So some of those controls are really big. Access control is the biggest one of them all. Other ones are very small, have maybe one control. But it's 130 controls. It goes from very generic ones. Do you have something like Active Directory in your system? Do you have a firewall? To how is this firewall configured? Do you have a VPN? How is this VPN configured? So it goes from very general controls to very specific controls that says, oh, if you have a VPN, you have to configure it this way. It's still very... very open, because they know they have to build this for 300,000 companies. So it doesn't say click X and then put this check mark there, but it's very clear you need to implement this feature in your system. And if this feature is not there, you need to have a replacement for it. Or it's one of the big ones, here are the really big ones, multi-factor for pretty much everything that is not offline. Get multi-factor for everything. That's a good cybersecurity advice for anybody anyway. We're still relying on pure passwords. Is behind the times and is will be suffering a major breach in short time if they don't even have been breached. One big thing. The other part is know what is going on in your network. Being that's a whole philosophy that goes over a lot of controls. Have an intimate knowledge about what is in your network, so you see if there is something happening that is different from normal, and then act on it. That's normally done via a scene tool, an event management tool, one thing. And then the other big ones is have the capability to deal with an incident, have the capability to react to something, be prepared, and have your plans already ready. And then there are little things that are in there. Make sure that you only use SSH when you talk to your switches. So it's a big bandwidth. It's 130 controls. But when you talk to people in IT, most of them understand what is going on. It's nothing that is esoteric. It's pure good cyber hygiene when you implement this. With one or two new tools, it's something just make your IT safe and have it as a habit. So that's the rub for it. I can go through each one of the controls. I can do it in my sleep, but it doesn't really help. But you have to address the overall culture of the company, of making it a habit that you always do the right thing and manage against it.
Okay, excellent. Now, before we switch gears and talk about a different topic here in this show, Bernhard, Tim, is there anything more you'd like to add on specifically about the CMMC?
No, I think we've covered it, you know, pretty well. You know, all I would say is if you haven't gotten started and you are, you know, a defense supplier, it really is in your best interest to do an assessment and understand what you need to do going forward. And the other thing I'd say is it's not as expensive as you think it is. There's a lot of talk about it's just unaffordable to get, you know, compliant in CMMC. And we've proven to some very small companies that it's doable and they can do it quickly and it doesn't break the bank. So, you know, make that investment. I know, you know, it's bottom line's hard to spend that money, but it also might save you from having a, you know, devastating breach. You know, so I think it's worth the investment, and it's not as much as you might think.
Well, what is the ballpark cost range, if you can answer that question?
Yeah, so doing like the readiness assessment, usually for a small company, a small company for us is under 100, you know, staff members, right? It might cost anywhere from $7,000 to $15,000 to do an assessment. Most of them cost around $7,000. If they're a little larger, 200, 300, 400, it's around $15,000. And then we can usually stand up and maintain, you know, a compliance program for, you know, again, a company around 50 to 100 users, you know, with all the tools and the processes and the policies, et cetera, starting from scratch, you know, for, you know, somewhere around, you know, $40,000 to $60,000 a year, because you have to continuously monitor and maintain this kind of cyber program. You know, so $4,000 or $5,000 a month, again, to get you compliant, keep you more secure, make you, you know, a better supplier to your prime or your customers, et cetera. That's typically what it costs.
Now let's segue back to SysArc. Are there any success stories that you'd like to share with us, like any customer testimonials or case studies or so?
So, Bernhard, why don't you talk about that one firm that's international weapons manufacturer and the things that we've done for them?
Yeah. So that's a company that is internationally present, has different subsidiaries in the U.S., is a provider, is a contractor with the DoD, and we were able to make sure that they, A, get their program started. We are managing their program to become compliant. And I think we have made a lot of steps there. We have also, for one of the subsidiaries, completely hardened their network. So that there's different elements there. They have consistently engaged us more in doing more for the company and working as they can on the international basis. We have performed all the assessments for them. And the assessment is really the first step that gets you onto the right path. And we are working with them to create the maturity, to create the consistency, and as I always like say, the habit. To become in the habit of being secure and doing the right things, and it's, I think we have now engaged with them over a year, and it's a growing engagement, and it's a growing trust relationship between everybody, between them and us, and we are really helping them to become compliant in a good time and in a time that will be consistently well executed.
Yeah, and one of my favorite success stories, if I might just talk about one more, is we're helping a small nuclear power company. They started with 25 employees. We were their managed service provider, building up, you know, their network and helping them manage that going forward. And over the last year, they have next generation nuclear power plant technology that's smaller and safer and less costly to build. And they've won 3 government contracts in the last year, one from DOD, so they had to have their DFARS 7012, soon to be CMMC stuff done, and a couple from the Department of Energy. And these are significant contracts for this company. It's could be into the billions of dollars over 7 or 10 years. So they've currently got about 200 employees. And we're managing their entire network, building out all their infrastructure for these contracts and doing their cybersecurity compliance work. And so we've helped them through this growth because they're growing like crazy, and it's hard to get, you know, computers to everybody and get them, you know, just so we've really spent a lot of time and effort with those folks and helping them, you know, through that growth period. So that I'm really excited about them, and they're in the Washington D.C. market, so they're close to us, and been a great relationship.
Excellent. Now, Tim and Bernard, either one of you can answer this question. Now, there are a lot. You know, there's what 2,000 plus, you know, cybersecurity vendors out there now. Everybody's kind of jumping on the bandwagon for the CMMC. What separates CISARC from the other cybersecurity vendors out there? So, for example, suppose I'm a defense contractor, and why should I come to you and say, hey, Tim, I want you to do the assessments and help me get certified? What's that one or two things that makes you different from everybody else?
I think we got started early on, right? As an MSP, we got started very early in this process with CMMC. So we've helped probably over 700 companies by now. We haven't done engagements with them all, but we've consulted with over 700 of these defense contractors in the last 4 years. So we've got way more experience. And as I said earlier, we've used that experience to really refine our process and be more efficient and lower the cost so that, you know, many of these small and medium-sized companies can afford this. And we're highly professional. We've got a great team, so we've built out this team. They've all been trained. So we just have, you know, way more experience, I think, through the 4 years and 700 people we've talked to, and we've got a great solution at a low cost. So I think it's hard to beat.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we come to the last part of our show here, I just kind of want to touch upon some general cybersecurity issues that made headlines last year and I'm sure will be filtering through in this year. The first one is cybersecurity insurance. Now, in the consulting work that you've done, Bernhard and Tim, like with compliance issues and other areas, has anyone asked you about cybersecurity insurance policies? And if so, do you actually deal anything in that area?
Bernard, why don't you talk about that customer in Bethesda that's a financial firm that we just talked to their insurance carrier about?
Yeah, sure. First of all, actually, when we go through an assessment and I'm talking about incident response, I will tell them to get, if they don't have a cyber insurance, get a cyber insurance. And if you have an event, if you have, like, for instance, there is a crypto locker in your device, one of the first calls will be to your insurance because they will help you out of there. So we are associated with some of the insurers that our clients have. We are first responders, approved first responders for them. So we encourage everybody to have cyber insurance and to take them very seriously and make them part of their incident response. Have this really as call number 2, depending on whoever is still there that they need to call, but the second call should be to the insurance. So that's something that we really take very seriously, and that we really encourage everybody to.
Yeah, and I would just add that, you know, because they've gone through our program, if they have, like they've implemented our cyber program, they need to let their insurance companies know that they're taking a lot of steps, because not every insurance company is doing a full audit or assessment of their customers, right, around cyber insurance at this point. But they should let their cyber insurance group know that they've gotten through our program, and you know this should reduce their premiums, but it may not.
Thank you. Excellent. Now, COVID-19 remote workforce, how has that impacted your business, your employees, your colleagues, and your clients? How are you dealing with the situation, and what do you tell clients? Or is this going to have an impact on the CMC certification process?
Well, let me take that, and Bernard, you can add to it. Well, first of all, you know, I'm very proud of our team, because as the managed service provider, we're basically managing the, you know, IT department for all of our customers. And we had, just like most MSPs, had to really go above and beyond to get everyone moved out to be able to work remotely, our customers being able to work remotely. And then our team is mostly, you know, working from home now. We got a few people in our office, but not many. So there was a lot of work there. Plus, all of our customers who we had already been doing cyber work for were in a better position, right, to work remotely. And Bernard, you can talk on the technical aspects of remote working and how that affects cyber. But in general, you know, it's been a lot of work to get that to make that happen. And I think one thing that I noticed, our customers are understanding, more understanding of how all the work that we do as an MSP to help keep them not only running remotely but safer as well. You know, but from a high level, that's how it's affected us. And Bernard, if you could touch on maybe technically how we've had to adapt to for our customers during this time, that'd be great.
For our DoD clients, actually, the CMMC was helping. Everybody was prepared and had good remote control, remote access practices enabled. So that was a good overlap there. Remote access is something that is a big element in CMMC. So we were able to make sure that all their VPNs are there, safe, are multi-factor enabled, and enable them to work efficiently. So that's one element for the traditional companies, and then we have the other elements, companies who are pretty much cloud-based already. And for them, it was almost a natural step. People were working from home instead of from the office, and it was a very organic step, essentially. We have seen this from many companies that it was, on the IT side, less of a step than expected, actually. So it was, in this way, actually a successful year to prove the concepts and the technologies that are out there.
Okay, excellent. Now, our final issue, and I think both of you could probably chime into this one, are the data privacy laws. Now, with this, I'm talking about primarily about the GDPR and the CCPA. Do you help clients and customers as well? Do you develop a compliance program for them, too, as you do for the CMMC?
Well, I'd say that we have, in the past, done a couple. But in general, we're not soliciting customers around that. We just feel that our value is in this CMMC niche, right, for the most part, or maybe NIST, you know, cybersecurity framework in broader terms that, you know, might have FISMA or other kinds of compliance needs. We do have a couple financial services customers that we've helped with SOC 2 and those kinds of audits and compliance requirements, but You know, in general, we want to be this niche player in the CMMC world, and so we're willing to help some of our current customers when they have issues that fall outside of that. But I think there's lots of room in the CMMC space for us and others.
Okay, excellent. Now, Tim and Bernhardt, we're in 2021. Now, barring anything by COVID-19 and any threats to supply chain in that regard, what do you think 2021 is going to look like for the cybersecurity threat landscape, and what do you think the biggest threat and variant is going to be? I think it's going to be the phishing ransomware thing attacked healthcare organizations, but what are your two cents on that?
Bernhard, that's you.
Yeah, that's me. Actually, I think we will see something that is not necessarily always end-user oriented. The phishing will definitely stay there, will not go away. Spear phishing will get better. The end-user is a great point of entry into every network. But as the FireEye and the consequent breaches that we have seen there, that's actually the supply chain for IT supply chain will be a bigger target. The tools that are used to manage it will be a bigger target. And I think what we are seeing with SolarWinds is the beginning, on the tip of the iceberg, I think. We have seen it already with more traditional MSPs who haven't really pivoted into security consciousness, that their tools are very, very powerful to get into the system. And that's something that we are taking very, very seriously, and where we are, that's stuff that keeps us awake at night, that we make sure that we are not becoming the backdoor. And because that will be the biggest challenge for this year, that we will see more SolarWinds attacks.
And the other thing I would, if I could add to that, is, out of the SolarWinds issue, may have been a silver lining when the new administration coming in has already said that cybersecurity is going to be a top priority for them, although not at the top, certainly COVID, et cetera, but they're going to at least be hopefully funding or looking at how we can be better prepared across our entire ecosystem around cybersecurity. So that to me is going to maybe be a positive impact in 2021 from a macro level.
Now, Tim and Bernhard, what do you tell people in general, like your family, friends, colleagues, clients? What do I do to mitigate the risk of being a victim of a cyber attack? I mean, I ask this at the end of every podcast for all my guests. So what are your thoughts on it?
Don't buy any gift cards for anybody.
Oh, come on. I just got a bunch of gift cards for Christmas.
No, that's one of those scams that everybody falls for, that someone I know fell for recently, where, you know, someone got an email from me as the owner of the company and was told to go buy some gift cards. And anyway, just don't click on any links. Take some cybersecurity awareness training.
Stop and think.
I'm just trying to have some fun with that one because,
it's amazing. The real lesson out of it is stop and think. Don't just do stuff automatically. Don't follow muscle memory. Stop and think every time.
Okay.
The internet is not a safe place.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. Now, I just want to add one more question there. Bernhard, or Tim, what are your thoughts on critical infrastructure, like attacks on nuclear facilities, power plants, food supply? Do you think that's going to be a big target this year, too, or that's going to be more of a later kind of threat variant? I mean, it's already there, but on a grander scale, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, I think the threat is there, the attack vectors are there, and they're definitely angling for it. In my experience, it's it goes in both directions. I think the protection is better than most people think, and it's maybe not as good as some people think. It will happen. I think this really depends on the circumstances. It's one kind of weapon, but it's almost a weapon of mass destruction. So if you use it, if someone is going to use an attack against the infrastructure right now, it will be that will be an act of war. So we will have to really see how this really goes well. So protection against it has to be definitely be better. There is protection for it that we sometimes are not aware of, but it can always be better. But this is will be a major deal if this happens. What of course can happen right now, and where we have to be aware of, and where we need to work against, is that if the adversary is in the system, that we find them and eliminate them. But for me, this is such a big deal. This is it's very scary to think about, and it can happen. But yeah.
Yeah, and I would add that it's typically been other nation states or bad actors or terrorists or et cetera. But now we're to some degree faced with our own people in the U.S. who may work at some of these places, and it's really hard to. To deal with insider threat. Again, as Bernard said, it's pretty scary. We need to always be improving on the, defensive side. But I'm hopeful that, we'll get better as a country on the offensive side of playing a little offense and going after, groups that we know. And as Bernard said, we don't want to get into war, but we have to do things as if we sort of are in some kind of, conflict, because we are consistently being attacked. So I'd like to see our capabilities on the offensive side as a country get stronger.
Okay. Now, finally, last two questions, Tim, Bernard. What is the best way for a person to get a hold of you in case they have questions about the CMMC or if they want to become a client? And two, I've done a lot of, as I said to you before, I've done a lot of writing on CMMC. And when I do a Google search for resources, there is just a lot of stuff out there. Do you have a list of consolidated resources like downloadable PDFs and missed publications on your website that are quickly and easily accessible to people who want to know more about it?
Yeah, I think our website's got a lot of good content, some stuff that we've been doing over the last several years. So, we're at www.sysarc.com, which is SYSARC.com. Going there, you can find and download some, information about what we're doing. And, our contact information's on there. Bernard's bio's on there. My bio's on there. You can probably reach us through that. But we're ready and able and willing and hopeful to help as many people as we can in this one particular issue. I mean, cyber in general is a challenge for a lot of companies, and we're doing our small part. We're a small company ourselves, but we're trying to help as many people as we can get to sort of where they need to be.
Excellent. Tim and Bernhardt, we thank you for your time. It's a late morning coming into the early afternoon here in Chicago. Have a great day, and we look forward to having you on some other future podcasts. Hopefully we can do a much deeper dive into a specific area of the CMMC as it continues to evolve here in the coming months.
All right. Thank you very much for having us, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Care. Thank you, Mark.